Hello there. Today is Tuesday, October 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump announces a new trade deal with Canada and Mexico.
The most important trade deal we've ever made by far.
In Washington, Democrats and Republicans continue to fight over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. A desperate situation is unfolding following an earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia.
There are reports in some areas of people trapped under houses, many, many houses that have collapsed in certain areas, and also people who were stuck in mud.
Also ahead, a tennis star goes topless for breast cancer awareness. It's all on today's International Edition as we begin with President Donald Trump Monday announcing a new trade agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, calling it the biggest trade deal in U.S. history. After intense last-minute discussions ahead of a self-imposed midnight deadline, U.S. and Canadian officials announced they've reached a deal allowing a modified three-way pact with Mexico to replace the nearly quarter-century-old North American Free Trade Agreement.
It will transform North America back into a manufacturing powerhouse. If you remember, the previous administration said, we're not going to have manufacturing jobs anymore, essentially. We're not going to make things anymore. No, just the opposite. It's going to be a manufacturing powerhouse and allow us to reclaim a supply chain that has been offshored to the world because of unfair trade issues.
The president, along with his Canadian and Mexican counterparts, plans to sign the agreement by the end of November. It will still need to be approved by Congress.
In theory, there should be no trouble, but anything you submit to Congress is trouble. No matter what, it's the single greatest agreement ever signed. They'll say, well, you know, Trump likes it, therefore we're not going to approve it.
Speaking in Ottawa, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the pact removed uncertainty, although he conceded Canada had to make some difficult compromises.
It's an agreement that removes uncertainty for our manufacturers and investors and improves labor rights for all North Americans. And it's an agreement that will be profoundly beneficial for our economy, for Canadian families, and for the middle class.
Canada's dairy industry criticized him for giving more market access to U.S. imports. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Pentagon cancels talks with China amid rising tensions. Pakistan hints at compromise on a jailed doctor who helped the U.S. The U.S. warns Iran moves its diplomatic personnel in Iraq, and living America's opioid nightmare. Find expanded coverage on these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The White House has given the Federal Bureau of Investigation authority to talk to anyone it wants to in its probe of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, as long as it's done by the end of the week. The apparent directive comes after Democratic criticism that the White House may have been trying to limit the scope of the investigation into sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh. Christine Blasey Ford testified last week before the Senate Judiciary Committee that Kavanaugh assaulted her at a party in 1982 when they were both in high school. Kavanaugh angrily denied the charges to the committee. Two other women have made similar sex abuse allegations against Kavanaugh. President Trump on Monday told reporters that the FBI should interview anyone they want within reason.
I want them to do a very comprehensive investigation, whatever that means, according to the senators and the Republicans and the Republican majority. I want them to do that.
Well, the New York Times says the FBI has already interviewed four witnesses that the White House and Senate Republicans approved for questioning. Kavanaugh's friend Mark Judge, or friends Mark Judge and P.J. Smith, Ford's friend Leland Kaiser, and Deborah Ramirez, one of the other women who has accused Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct. Joining us now to talk more about the whole legality of all this is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University.
They'll be working hard, but yes. And when you say the White House says that they can, you know, do whatever they want, I'm a little skeptical of that, because my understanding was that Lawyer McGahn at the White House was the one providing instruction about scope. But set that aside. The FBI can bear in mind, the great thing from the FBI standpoint is they've got a huge number of employees and offices all across the country. And so they can, you know, dispatch people to, you know, anywhere in the country and interview and come up with good information. The problem, of course, is that they will not be calling people with subpoenas, so they need to obtain witnesses who are willing to talk. And I expect some people are not going to be interested in talking, you know, just because they don't want to get involved. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. I think Judge Kavanaugh made a pretty serious mistake. He announced that he had prepared his own testimony, mm-hmm. and it looked like it, sounded like it. I don't think if he had had a lawyer review it, I don't mm-hmm. think most good lawyers would have approved of some of the stuff he said.
You mentioned that he made some errors. There is a lot of talk that it really went beyond just the initial allegations against him, but in his own testimony and his temperament and delivery.
I agree with that. I think some of it was substance, but I think a lot of it is temperament and delivery. One wants, of all good qualities of good judges, one of them is temperament. And in watching the statement of Judge Kavanaugh, it looked at sometimes when he was almost a bit unhinged. And I don't think any good lawyer, if a good lawyer reviewed his testimony, would have approved of, let's go after the Democrats and the conspiracy and all the rest. You know, that's the kind of talk that people who wear tinfoil on their heads, that's the kind of way they speak. And I don't think he did himself any favor in that way.
NBC has been reporting today that they have information regarding friends of Mr. Kavanaugh's from high school and college who have texts of him apparently sort of working behind the scenes to try to get them to say, you know, to stick up for him or to say things weren't true or to just cover himself, so to speak. Is that something that is okay in this type of situation?
No, it absolutely is not. If this were in a trial context, that's called witness tampering. And it is actually one of the more serious crimes because it tends to undermine the rule of law. Now, I don't think in this context it is. But that cannot be helpful if that story is verified and people come out of the woodwork saying, yeah, he called me and asked me to say nice things about him. I think that would be really damning. One of the problems that I think that Judge Kavanaugh created for himself is he refused to acknowledge sort of any drinking. You know, later on he said, yeah, I'd have, you know, so a couple of beers on Saturday or something. But I think most lawyers advising him would have said, yeah, I drank a hell of a lot when I was in college and high school, and I don't remember a lot of it. I know I didn't do what I've been charged with, but certainly I drank. By sort of adopting the Mother Teresa mien, he stretches credulity.
It didn't seem to matter much to Republicans. You know, obviously we're in a very, very partisan political atmosphere here.
Yes. That's what they say, and I expect that for some number they're right. I mean, that is to say, we don't care what the character of this guy is. We think we know how he'll vote. He'll be one of us. He's reasonably young, so therefore he can be on the court for another, 25, 30 years. So we're going to go with him no matter what. I don't think, though, that that's probably true of everyone. I would think that some people would be able to, you know, get outside their political party in their minds and say, wait a minute, is this really the kind of person we want on the Supreme Court?
All right, Robert Deitz, we appreciate your perspective. He is a professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. The 2018 Nobel Prize in Medicine has been awarded to two scientists, one American, one Japanese, who were instrumental in the development of cancer immunotherapy. The AP's Warren Levinson has more.
Jim Allison says it's especially gratifying to have a Nobel Prize awarded for basic research. Allison of the MD Anderson Cancer Center says, I didn't set out to cure cancer.
I got into it because I wanted to know how T cells work.
Allison discovered a way to take the brakes off the immune system, freeing it up to kill tumor cells.
I think that immunotherapy is going to be part of the therapy that essentially all cancer patients are going to receive.
Allison's here for a conference where his wife is speaking. News of the prize came in an early morning phone call, not from the prize committee, but from his son, then from a Swedish reporter, then the Nobel people tracked him down. Warren Levinson, New York.
Well, the extent of the devastation caused by an earthquake and tsunami on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi should become clearer on Tuesday as the rescuers push into remote areas that have been out of contact for more than 3 days. Indonesia's president has authorized the acceptance of urgent foreign aid for humanitarian efforts in the province of central Sulawesi, which was hit Friday by the double disaster of an earthquake and tsunami. Aid agencies and foreign governments, including the U.S., have pledged assistance. President Donald Trump spoke briefly of the disaster Monday.
We have already sent a lot of first responders and military and others to help, but it's a really bad, bad situation.
The number of confirmed deaths has exceeded 840, but officials fear the death toll could rise into the thousands when rescuers gain access to remote areas. With communications down and access by land limited, rescuers are struggling to reach communities closer to the epicenter of Friday's quake. Survivors describe how it all unfolded.
I was carried by the wave about 50 meters. I couldn't hold on to anything. The water was spinning me around. There was a shop with bars over the front. I climbed it. That was where I rested. Then a second wave came, even higher than the first. Suddenly, I was on the roof.
Indonesia's disaster agency said about 1,700 houses in one Palu neighborhood were swallowed up. The AP's Margie Mason says rescue teams are trying to dig up hundreds of people believed to be buried.
There are reports in some areas of people trapped under houses, many, many houses that have collapsed in certain areas, and also people who were stuck in mud where the earthquake caused a phenomenon called liquefaction, which is almost like a quicksand-type phenomenon.
Franz Potok-Damon, a former VOA director in Jakarta, was on Sulawesi when the earthquake hit. He tells us what happened as the quake struck.
At the time the earthquake and tsunami hit Palu, I was visiting some radio affiliate in Sigi Regency near Palu. And at the time of the earthquake, I was discussing with station manager of one radio affiliate there in Palu and their broadcaster, their journalist, you know, about the VOA content, about how to improve their programming, something like that. And around 5 minutes to 6 p.m., I called the taxi to come to pick me up. But when the taxi was on the way to the radio stations, the earthquake suddenly hit the city at Palu, and then all of us tried to save ourselves, to run to the one small doors. Some of them were falling down, and we went to a parking lot near the radio stations to keep calm because the earthquake was so big. You know, I feel myself that it was not only horizontally moved, but also vertically. Vertical movement of the mm-hmm. earth, not mm-hmm. only the horizontal movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, very big one. The walls of the house and the buildings near the stations were falling down. We were afraid to go to the street because there was between the church there and the building at the right side. So we stay about 10 minutes in the parking lot, but we were also afraid because the tower of the radio station, 60 meters height, was almost falling down to the parking lot. That's why, you know, we just wait for about maybe 10 minutes and we ran out to the street and joined all the people there who were, you know, very panicked at the time.
How did you finally get off the island?
Yeah, on Saturday morning, I thought that I have to get out of the island as soon as possible. I have the flight of the airline flight at 4 p.m. at that day. But I think I should go to the Mercure Hotel where I stay to pick up all my baggage, you know, and my laptops and others. So I went there to the hotel and I was shocked because the hotel was, you know, devastated. The car parking in the front of the hotel was swept away by the tsunami, and now they were in the lobby of the hotel. More than half of the building was, you know, ruined. And I found there, nobody there, but there are some, you know, dead bodies around the lobby near the hotels, you know. So I decided, I couldn't get my bag, so I decided to go to the airport and to sleep there at the parking lot of the airport under the trees, waiting if there is a flight, you know, going out to Makassar, South Sulawesi, or to Jakarta in Java. I should try to get on board. And then at around afternoon, around 4 p.m. in the afternoon, there was a Hercules letter coming, and the Armed Forces Commander coming, and the next day also helicopter, and they could pick me to back to Jakarta with other people.
Okay, and is that where you are now, in Jakarta?
Yeah, I'm now in Jakarta, yeah.
Okay.
Back to my house.
All right, well, the hardest hit areas appear to have been the region of Donggala and the city of Palu, with a combined population of about 1.4 million. Initial reports from Red Cross rescuers who had reached the outskirts of Donggala district were chilling. So far, nearly 60,000 people have been displaced, and the UN estimates nearly 200,000 are in need of emergency help. Las Vegas, Nevada is known worldwide as a center of gambling, resorts, shopping, and entertainment. But 1 year ago Monday, it also became the site of the worst mass shooting by an individual in the United States. 64-year-old Stephen Paddock fired more than 1,000 rifle rounds from an upper-story hotel window into hundreds of people before killing himself as people closed in. He killed nearly 60 people and wounded hundreds. VOA's Carolyn Frasutti returned to Las Vegas to see if much has changed at this popular stop for tourists around the world.
It's Lacey West's wedding day.
The most stressful, exciting day of my life.
And it's the same weekend as the worst day of her life, 1 year ago. Lacey and her mom, Elizabeth, were running from bullets at a country music concert in Las Vegas. The shooter, firing from this angle, an upper floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort, killed 58 and injured more than 800.
We had no clue that it was just an aerial attack, that we were never really out of danger.
Yeah, we had the tattoos put on our forearms where we had linked arms when we ran through the venue, so this is where we linked arms. So that's why the tattoos are where they're at.
Just remember to smile and enjoy that moment.
But a year later, Lacey and Josh are creating joyful memories to replace her nightmare.
It just touches my heart because it was such a difficult time for us to go through.
Having my anniversary be the memory every year leading into October 1st will just be the reminder of how my life changed so much from that event that it led me to my happiness.
Lacey and Elizabeth have changed. So has the city.
For gamblers and tourists, the Las Vegas Strip may look the same, but security experts say it's what you don't see that keeps you safe.
There's a lot of security that's not in security uniforms.
We took David Shepard on a ride down the Strip to point out safety updates. Before starting his own firm, he headed the security at the Venetian, the world's second biggest hotel and casino.
See that little white thing? That's a counter. The only place you don't have cameras is bathrooms.
Shepard says some hotels have installed sensors that alarm if someone breaks a window, like Stephen Paddock did for his shooting perch. Mandalay Bay has renumbered its floors to eliminate Paddock's 32nd floor, and his suite will never be rented to tourists. Sidewalks are lined with barriers to prevent vehicles from ramming into crowds. Restaurants also felt the pain. Ricky and Jen Ruff serve up Filipino food in the shadow of the Mandalay.
Business here dropped probably around 20%. And it dropped because people just went in the morning.
The same with James Ramos's real estate deals.
It drastically affected the tourism that was coming into town.
But both businesses have since rebounded. The 58 crosses have moved from the grass at the beginning of the Strip to a spot next to 58 portraits of the victims, each painted by a different artist. Both memorials are breathtaking in magnitude, in a city still working to heal and find hope.
I will stand by your side.
I will stand by your side.
A year after the tragedy. Carolyn Frasutti, VOA News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Phew! Finally, it's the weekend. Hi, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Do you want to maximize your precious weekend? Milk it for all it's worth before Monday hits again? I can help you with that. Just tune in to your local station this Sunday at 1505 and 2005 Universal Time and listen. Imagine 55 minutes of commercial-free Pan-African music. This Sunday features music and music news from the soil.
I'm the beatboxer, the guy who does the pupuchino.
Bobby Wine, Ishun, Atot Manje, and more. Maximize it, peeps, this Sunday on Music Time in Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, for the first time in more than 2 years, a straight-up comedy is number one at the U.S. box office. Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish's Night School debuted with $28 million in ticket sales, according to Sunday's estimates. The race for the weekend top spot was, in the end, a laugher. Warner Brothers animated release Smallfoot, which cost about $80 million to make, trailed in second with $23 million. Joining us now is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard, who has seen both movies. Jeff, let's start with Kevin Hart's new film. He's apparently going to night school.
That's right. Kevin Hart, this is his first movie under his own production company, and his character dropped out of high school. He wanted to learn from the school of life, so he was one of those students that just could not pay attention in class. So he wanted to go out and make his mark in the world, and he ended up selling barbecues for 15 years. And, of course, you know, all good things coming to an end. He lost his job, so now he can get a job as a financial planner with one of his old high school buddies, but he has to go back to night school to get his GED. And so there's the setting for our comedy of night school, because Tiffany Haddish plays his night school teacher, and she's dedicated to education. She's got a master's degree. She cares about her students. But Kevin Hart, he has different plans. He's been a con man his whole life. So he thinks he can sweet talk his way to his degree and, you know, to cut corners, and she's not going to have anything of it. And, of course, he's got a whole school behind him. Taron Killam plays the principal, who was one of the kids he used to pick on in high school. So there's an added pressure there. And the classmates he has also trying to get a GED in there are a bunch of rogues, a bunch of crazy characters. Unfortunately, in the movie, you know, you just don't like Kevin Hart's character. He is just despicable. There's nothing likable about him. Of course, in his story arc, by the end of the movie, he's changed, right? But it's a little bit too little too late. And the sight gags and the humor coming out from being in night school, it just wears on you. And I like Kevin Hart, don't get me wrong, but if you're not a fan of his comedy style, his whining, it just really gets old after an hour and a half. So overall, night school, I felt like I was being held back in junior high for the whole time.
So obviously it wouldn't be top on your list to recommend for people to go see.
No. Unless you're a definite Kevin Hart fan, you can go check it out. But if you're looking for a good laugh, you're not going to find it here. You're just going to find it 2 hours of study hall detention.
Well, it sounds like we at least have a pretty good animated film that might excite people a little bit. Smallfoot,
yeah. We have a great family film here. It's the story of Migo. He's a Yeti living up there on the rooftop of the world in Nepal. He lives in a whole village of Yetis. And there's a rumor about a Smallfoot. You know, it's a play on words like Bigfoot. So this time, there's a legend of the Smallfoot, which are human beings. And a plane kind of crashes next to Migo's mountain, and he finds the pilot who ejected, and he sees the little Smallfoot. He goes back to the village and says, "Hey, everyone, I saw a Smallfoot," and it sends a panic because the lawgiver, the stoneholder, played by Common, he's like, "No, there's no such thing. Stop spreading rumors. You're causing a panic." So Migo's banned from his village, and he sets out to find this Smallfoot to prove to everyone that it exists. And he goes down to the village where the humans are, and James Corden provides the voice of this adventurer who has his own television show, and his ratings are in the dump. So he's going to find a Yeti and photograph it and get his TV show back on top. So overall, the movie is so funny. Channing Tatum is great as Migo. You've got Common. You've got Zendaya, who was in The Greatest Show. She provides one of her voices for a character, does some songs in the movie. And usually when these movies are great for kids, but adults are kind of bored, this has some great fun for adults, too. I mean, I had such a good time with this movie. I was smiling. I was tapping my feet to the great songs. You know, Smallfoot really hits home. It's really a great family adventure.
All right. Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Serena Williams is going topless to promote breast cancer self-examination. AP correspondent Warren Levinson has that story.
Serena Williams says this wasn't easy to do, standing topless in front of a camera singing the late Chrissy Amphlett's song, "I Touch Myself." When I think about you, I
touch myself.
But for breast cancer self-awareness, the tennis star was willing to take herself out of her comfort zone. The video is part of a campaign to promote breast self-examination, for which Amphlett's 1990 anthem has been used numerous times. The singer herself died of breast cancer 5 years ago. Williams says in an Instagram post, early detection saves lives. Warren Levinson, New York.
This is Science in a Minute.
The first Nobel Science Prize in physiology or medicine was announced on Monday, October 1st. Professor Thomas Perlman at the Karolinska Institute made the announcement.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institutet has today decided to award the 2018 Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine jointly to James P. Allison and Tasco Honjo for their discovery of cancer therapy by inhibition of negative immune regulation.
The new Nobel laureates were awarded the prize for their research in the stimulation of our own immune system to attack tumor cells. The Nobel Assembly said through their work, an entirely new principle for cancer therapy has been established. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, it's hard to miss some of the trash and recycling trucks rumbling through the streets of the U.S. nation's capital. 25 of them are covered with colorful artwork ranging from birds, flowers, and butterflies to abstract images. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the trucks are a big hit.
It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. And in this Washington, D.C. neighborhood, these sanitation workers' job is made a bit more pleasant by rolling with Shelby, the name of the vibrant abstract artwork on their truck.
That's real fun. It's more attention. I like the attention.
Sanders Wright is proud of the truck, which is wrapped with a vinyl copy of the original painting. The art-covered trucks began hitting the streets 5 years ago. They are part of a city initiative to promote recycling while showcasing local artist talent. The original paintings, drawings, and mixed media are copied onto large pieces of vinyl to be placed on the trucks. The residents here enjoy watching Shelby come by.
It's pretty cool. Add some color to the neighborhood.
Wright says people have become friendlier since the art initiative began, getting to know the workers by name, even bringing them cookies and other treats.
It just make you feel good that you can have some citizens come out or the children to say, hey, that's a nice truck. I like that art. I like your truck. And you just blow the toot the horn or say, wave to them, thank you.
I think the art design of the truck is really nice. It's another opportunity for an artist to show what he can do.
And that includes painter Michael Crossett.
This takes my art and puts it onto a truck that's going to get seen in a diverse amount of communities.
Crossett painted the original image over photos that include the U.S. Capitol.
It's actually a combination of probably 250 images. Then it was digitized to be placed on the truck.
The painting shows the vibrancy of Washington.
The international view of D.C. is so political. It's a different world when you're actually living here and a resident. So I, in my paintings, generally show the street life and the energy that is D.C.
Crossett even welcomes the predictable dirt and trash on the image.
Grit and garbage is part of city living, and I think having my art mixed in with that is a perfect thing. I use actually images of grit or images of concrete to gritty up my work. So in the end, I think this is the perfect kind of marriage that some trash will add to the color of my art.
Eventually, the harsh conditions take their toll, and the trucks have to be rewrapped every couple of years. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.